now, what you're always living right now. What about when it's not just our own life, but the whole world that seems to be melting down in crisis? Many people feel that way these days as they see the environment, human rights, civil liberties, and the notion of truth itself under attack by reckless, sickeningly ignorant chieftains. There are so many fronts to fight on, so many lies to challenge, so many insults to basic decency and kindness, that nothing we do seems enough. Some people swing back and forth. They obsessively read every horrific news item till they're choking on stress. Then they withdraw completely. Then they feel guilty and swing back again. Sometimes the only measure of sanity seems to come from the late-night comedians. But even the laughter they provoke can seem like a stolen consolation, blunting our proper outrage. But we're not the first to go through such times. In 1946, as the unspeakable slaughter and suffering of the Second World War was giving way to the Cold War and the threat of nuclear holocaust, the great Christian writer C.S. Lewis put this in a letter to a friend. One mustn't assume burdens that God does not lay upon us. It is one of the evils of rapid diffusion of news that the sorrows of all the world come to us every morning. I think each village was meant to feel pity for its own sick and poor, whom it can help, and I doubt if it is the duty of any private person to fix his mind on ills which he cannot help. This may even become an escape from the works of charity we really can do to those we know. A great many people do now seem to think that the mere state of being worried is in itself meritorious. I don't think it is. We must, if it so happens, give our lives for others. But even while we're doing it, I think we're meant to enjoy our Lord, and in Him, our friends, our food, our sleep, our jokes, and the birds' song and the frosty sunrise. It is very dark, but there's usually light enough for the next step or so. This all seems even more valid today than it did when Lewis wrote it. Now news is diffused even more rapidly, giving us even more opportunities to fix our minds on ills we cannot help, and to mistake noble soliloquies on Facebook for the works of charity we really can do. And there are things you can do. Just take that next step or so. In any given situation, in any given moment, there's a most skillful, compassionate way to act. Releasing worry gives us more space to see what it is. Do what you can do. Don't worry about what you can't do. And certainly don't go into a tailspin of dejection over it. It won't help. Then, in whatever light is available, look around. Then, take the next step. Chapter 6. Resting Bliss Face. Now we're going to talk about smiling. That may sound peachy to you, or it may make you bristle. You may be thinking, hey, I'm in pain. Don't talk to me about smiling. That's fine. The sages and the scientists are on my side. Just stick with me and see what happens. You may recall a meme that trended online a while back, RBF, or Resting Bitch Face. It featured photos of people, usually female celebrities, wearing apparently bored, miffed, or sullen expressions. The owner of the face may well have just been concentrating or taking a break from posturing for cameras, but the trolls, with their customary gallantry, were delighted to pounce and to pronounce their victim a bitch. This is obviously sexist and obviously dumb, but it does have a context. Research has shown that onlookers will generally interpret photos of resting, unsmiling faces as hostile or otherwise negative, even when the owner of the face intended simple neutrality. So, as a simple, practical tactic of social lubrication, if nothing else, smiling is a good idea. It signals to others, things are okay, relax. That's just good manners. And your smile, or your lack thereof, communicates something to yourself as well. The mind-body connection is a two-way street. As the Vietnamese Zen master Thich Nhat Hanh has said, sometimes your joy is the source of your smile, but sometimes your smile can be the source of your joy. Does this mean you should plaster a forced, insincere smile across your face when you feel like crap? No. We all know how hollow that fake smile looks and feels. Awakening is about coming out of what's false, not adding to it. But there's a way to make the smile real. Please start by deliberately assuming your resting bitch face. Even exaggerate it a little. Make it harder, bitchier. Notice how that makes you feel. Ugh. Next, try a big, fake smile. Pull back the corners of your mouth while you keep the rest of your face immobile, dead. Notice how that feels. Double ugh, and it looks stupid. So, let's start again. Go back to RBF. This time, we're going to use our eyes. The old saying is that the eyes are the windows to the soul, and the neuronal pathway between the eyes and the brain is very short. So, smile with your eyes. That is, imagine that you're doing with your eyes what your mouth does in a genuine smile, narrowing slightly and letting the warm feeling of a smile take over and pull their outer corners back and slightly up. At first, keep your mouth frozen, playing hard to get with the smiling eyes, till it can no longer resist, and the smile slowly spills or suddenly bursts through the mouth's emotional dam. That breakthrough will, in turn, feed back to your brain, making you feel smilier still. As that happens, relax. Settle back into the smile, whether it's just a soft hint of a smile or a broad grin, as if you're settling back on a big, soft, squishy cushion. You'll probably find that this whole sequence makes you feel at least a little bit happier, and maybe a lot. You get an instant squirt of endorphins, which produce general positivity, so you fear less, anger less, crave less, and so forth. This method also gives you a warm, genuine, happy smile that you can share with others, thus spreading the wealth and making your home or work environment a more positive place. In fact, Swedish researchers have found that smiling is contagious. It's hard to maintain your RBF when others smile at you. That's one of the reasons why we keep smiling entertainers around. If you can hold the corners of your mouth pulled back and dance at the same time, you can be a rockette. If you can summon a genuine, endorphin-flooding smile from so deep inside that it's as if the sun's in your heart and you're ready for love, then you're Gene Kelly performing Singin' in the Rain. He filmed that sequence while running a high fever. The stuff works. The notion that facial expressions can be a cause as well as an effect of emotions is called the facial feedback hypothesis, and its roots go back to Darwin. Over the years, it's been tested in various ingenious ways. Recent research has shown that using Botox to immobilize the frowning muscles can reduce depression. I like the study that had participants hold a pen while watching a cartoon and then rate how funny it was. Group A had to hold the pen between their lips, forcing them to frown. Group B held it between their teeth, forcing a smile, and the control group held it in their hand. Group B found the cartoon funnier, demonstrating that even a mechanical, mouth-only smile can give the brain some happy feedback. There's yet another way to do this that works better than a pen between your teeth. You've probably heard of mantras, sounds whose psychoacoustic qualities can be used to tune our consciousness, the best known being Om. But here's another, slightly less traditional one. A dear friend once told me, "Dean, always remember, no matter what's happening, you can never have a bad time as long as you just say, 'Whee!'" This mantra is most effective if you combine it with the proper mudra or hand gesture. As you exclaim it, throw your hands up and out like a person exclaiming, "Whee!" Do this 3 times and then try to feel depressed. I dare you. If you really want to test the power of the smile, try making up your mind to apply it at least, let's say, 6 times a day. You can be on your commute, working at your desk, walking your dog, or doing anything else. When you first wake up in the morning, before you get out of bed, do a smile or 2 or 3 to set the tone of the day and short-circuit the habitual negative loops that, till now, might have kicked in. Identify some of the usual stress points of your daily routine and try applying your smile topically. As you walk up to the podium, when you deal with a difficult client, or just before you jump off the diving board, whatever kind of board you have to jump off of. When you talk to people on the phone, whether socially or for business, do it with your warm smile on, and you'll probably notice that they respond to you more positively. They can't see you, but they'll feel you. If you combine this with the technique of relaxing at the moment of contact, which we introduced in Chapter 3, it will be especially powerful. After a while, you may find that this way of functioning becomes automatic, so you no longer need to deliberately choose it. Welcome to your new default face, resting bliss face, and your new default mood. Our brain prefers happiness to unhappiness. We only need to cooperate a little, and it will rewire itself for happiness. That's what's happening here. Chapter 7. Snakes on a Plane. A reader in Manchester, England, recently sent me an email. He wrote, "I once asked a Catholic priest who was on a 12-step program, 'What's the difference between religion and spirituality?' He replied, 'In my opinion, religion is for people who pray to God so as not to go to hell. Spirituality is for people who have already been there and are now looking for a way back home.'" If you're reading this book, there's a good chance you've been to hell, or at least some pretty serious heck. Fear, anger, addiction, grief, guilt, confusion, loneliness, something has set your hair on fire. Like the prodigal son, most people are happy to party on till one day they've run out of money, or health, or family, or stories, or good looks, or luck, and they hit bottom. The prodigal son, having demanded his inheritance early and then burned through it, finds himself in a faraway land, feeding pigs for pennies and envying them for the garbage they eat. Only then does he think of making his way back home. An updated version of that hair-on-fire moment occurs in 2006's most sublimely dopey film, Snakes on a Plane. After the 450 deadly snakes set loose in the cabin have finally attacked one passenger too many, our FBI agent hero, played by Samuel L. Jackson, boils over with exasperation. Preparing to shoot out some windows so the snakes will be sucked out into the thin air, he utters the certified 55th greatest movie line of all time. All together now. "I have had it with these motherfucking snakes on this motherfucking plane." There's something about this line that's irreducibly great. It's like a formula in algebra. You can substitute values to make it work in all sorts of situations. "I have had it with these motherfucking commercials on this motherfucking television. I have had it with these motherfucking trolls on the motherfucking web. I have had it with these motherfucking cancer cells on my motherfucking MRI. I have had it with these motherfucking clowns in the motherfucking Congress." And, more to the point for us, I have had it with this motherfucking fear or rage or anxiety or addiction in my motherfucking life. Not everyone has to reach such a dramatic breaking point. The teachings are out there. By now, anyone who doesn't live under a rock has at least heard the word meditation and knows, at least in some vague way, that it's supposed to smooth out your life. We're past the days when people could routinely dismiss it as some Eastern cult or hippie-trippy fantasy. Now there are meditation classes at the Y and meditation apps for your phone. Some people just quietly realize that their already good lives can be even better. They check out the available resources and go for it. They don't need a bowling ball to fall on their head. But our old stories, our old models of life, even when they feed our suffering, have the power of momentum going for them. We've invested a lot of practice in them. We know how to do them. So a lot of people need that bowling ball. It may be an illness, the death of a loved one, the end of a marriage, the crash and burn of a career, the bottom of an addiction, but they need some kind of pain to catch their attention, some breakdown of their old model of life to make it clear that it no longer works, if it ever really did. One way or another, they need to find themselves at the juncture described by the great bebop comic Lord Buckley. They didn't know where they was going, but they know they had to go 'cause they know where they wasn't it. So your fear, your anger, your busted business, your fractured family, your heart attack, whatever crisis has brought you here has been a blessing, a wake-up call. Yeah, easy for me to say. Depending on how raw your pain is, there's a good chance you don't recognize it as a blessing right now. Fine. It's enough that it spurs you to start looking for a way back home. The prodigal son approaches his father's place, intending to beg for a job alongside the lowest of the servants. But while he was still a long way from home, his father saw him, and his heart went out to him. He ran and hugged his son and kissed him. This is one of the most poignant moments in our literature. We've all screwed up. We've all wasted time. We've all felt confused and perhaps seriously lost, but it's not too late. We just need to take the first stumbling steps back in the general direction of where we came from, the source, the silence at our core, the boundless okayness, our true home, our true father. Then it comes running to embrace us, even when we're still a long way from home. Till now we've been dodging this problem or that affliction like dodging one snake after another. But now we're enlisting boundlessness, the wide open sky that envelops the little airplane of our life, to suck out all the snakes at once. You have to fasten your seatbelt and shoot out a few windows, break through your separation from that sky, but then there's nothing to do but let it happen. You don't do it, it does you. Call it meditation, or call it grace, or don't call it anything at all, but give it all up to that bigger space that surrounds you. Fear, grief, rage, bitter disappointment, our various afflictions may look and feel different, but they're all forms of the same primal suffering, which is the sense of isolation, of being alone and cut off, like a wave without an ocean. But there's no such thing as a wave without an ocean. The sages, Buddha, Jesus, Shankara, and people you've never heard of, some of whom you may have passed in the street, are not gods. They're ordinary human beings who yawn and scratch and pick their teeth just like you, but who have managed to wake up out of isolation and suffering. They've shot out their windows and their snakes are gone. What they report back is that every one of us can do the same. Part 2. Rest as Awareness. Chapter 8. Settling Happens. It's time to introduce our core practice, natural meditation, the wide open doorway into the space beyond fear. The one recommendation for the smoothest ride is to set aside any assumptions based on what you may have read, imagined, or previously practiced about what you're supposed to do or what's supposed to happen when you meditate. This will be simpler and easier than all that. I'd actually love to abolish the word meditation, which sounds like some kind of big, exotic task. We'll be hanging out in tasklessness. The Italians have a lovely expression for this, dolce far niente, sweet doing nothing. In case you're thinking, wait, I don't know anything about this, I'm just a beginner, then congratulations, you're starting fresh, without any bad habits to unlearn. If you've been doing other forms of meditation, for now, please allow yourself to be a beginner again, with a blank slate. To enter into the kingdom of heaven, we are told, be like a little child. No advanced placement credit will be given. Abandon all sophistication, ye who enter here. Now I'm going to walk us through the meditation, and of course you can come back to this chapter for repeated sessions. Soon, as you connect with the simplicity of the process, you will probably find your need for external guidance starting to fall away. Don't worry about getting everything right. As long as you're taking it easy, letting everything be however it is, that's the essence of natural meditation, and that is right. For now, please leave your eyes open, but we'll be closing them soon, so don't do this while driving. Sit comfortably. If you sat uncomfortably, you'd be all set for unnatural meditation. You might want to shake out your hands a little, then let them flop loosely onto your lap or knees. Any time during the session that you need to adjust your position, straighten your leg, scratch your elbow, blow your nose, or do anything else to remain comfortable, go ahead. So, we are sitting comfortably. Now what? Now there's probably some sense of expectation as you anticipate launching into this new activity, some sense of turning the key in the ignition, feeling the engine start to rumble and saying, here we go. But what if we don't start the car? We just roll the top down, yeah, it's a convertible, lean back in our seat, toss the key into the bushes, and say, here we are. Here we are, sitting back, no rumble, nowhere to go, leaving everything as it is, just enjoying the scenery. Okay, then. As we're sitting back in this lazy way, let's take a look around. What's in that scenery? What's already going on in our experience without our doing anything about it? Well, naturally, seeing is going on. As we look around, up or down, left or right, the colors and shapes of different objects come in and out of view. No matter what's there, naturally, we're aware of it. This is nothing special. In fact, it's been happening all our life. Naturally, we're aware of sensations as well. You might feel your back and bottom pressing against the seat, the temperature of the air, or inner sensations of being alert or sleepy, hungry or full. Awareness of hearing is also going on. Perhaps the sounds of passing traffic, birds, a distant airplane, a barking dog. Now, please notice whether it takes any effort to hear what you hear. Nope, no effort. Hearing just arises within our awareness, without our doing anything about it. Also, Notice whether you have any control over what you hear. Can you choose what sound will arise in the next moment? No again. Hearing just happens, arising in our awareness without our effort or control. Notice that the same goes for feeling and seeing. Everything we're aware of arises and changes on its own. Fine. Now let's close our eyes. That's all. No meditating, please. Just continue in here we are mode, only with the eyes closed. What's changed? Actually, not much. We still see, even if it's only vague colors or hazy patterns behind our eyelids. Naturally, the other senses continue as well, with no effort or control from us. Perfect. Since it's all out of our control, let's just rest in the situation as it is, however it is. Sounds, colors, sensations. Notice that all the things we're aware of come and go like breezes in the sky. Only the sky doesn't come and go. And the sky, in this case, is awareness itself. Just rest in awareness, like open sky, open space, within which everything else comes and goes on its own. Notice that thoughts and feelings also come and go, arising and changing and vanishing, just like sounds or colors. That's also perfect. Just more breezes coming and going in the open sky of awareness. Don't hang on to them, and don't try to push them away. Sounds are just sounds. Thoughts are just thoughts. The sky has room for every kind of breeze and is not affected by any of them. Sounds, colors, feelings, thoughts. Everything comes and goes within our awareness, like breezes coming and going frictionlessly in the open sky. Even a hurricane doesn't damage the sky. So just rest back into this sky-like, open awareness, without bothering much about what comes and goes within it. Don't try to focus or concentrate on anything. Don't try to control the mind or feel some special way. Just continue to relax back into this awareness, which is like open space, which is always present, and within which everything else comes and goes, without our managing or monitoring it. Sometimes thoughts about a particular subject may seem very persistent and gripping, even obsessive. That's fine. Don't try to push the thoughts away, and don't hang on to them. Just relax your grip on them, and don't worry about whether they continue to hang around. Anytime you find yourself holding on to a thought or feeling or anything else, or trying to push it away, just relax your grip on it. Whether it goes away or persists doesn't matter. Again and again, just relax your grip and sink back into yourself. Sink back into open, sky-like awareness. Just rest in awareness. That's simple. Marinate in it. Soak in it, like soaking in a hot tub. Now, keep your eyes closed. But start easing the body back to a more active state. You can change your sitting position, stretch your limbs, perhaps squeeze your hands or gently rub your scalp or eyes. Get the blood circulating again. When you feel ready, after about 2 or 3 minutes, you can start to slowly open your eyes. Take as much time as you need. Good. What happened? Okay, that's how simple it is, resting in the awareness that's already there. Nothing more. Whatever comes and goes, sounds, sensations, feelings, thoughts, just let it all come and go, without trying to do anything about it. Even that word let is too much. Notice that it comes and goes and that you can't do anything about it. You're an innocent bystander, not a participant. After bystanding like that for a little while, you may have noticed some feeling of relaxation, some settling down into inner silence. Maybe for most of the session, maybe just for brief moments here or there. Maybe you're noticing it now in the afterglow. So, what made you relax? Did we give you a nice massage? Did we administer meds? Did we make a large deposit in your savings account? No. Did you do yoga postures or special breathing techniques? No, not that either. Then what did you do? Well, you started with a very quiet, subtle shift of attention to notice your own awareness and rest there. But then, nothing. This is the crux of natural meditation, the fundamental principle. Settling happens by itself. Think of leaves falling from a tree. They tell the whole story. A falling leaf will reach the ground in 100% of cases. It may drift to the left or right. It may catch a momentary updraft. It may even get stuck in a lower limb for a while. But in its own good time, it will reach the ground because it's pulled by gravity. Gravity is irresistible and universal, attracting all bodies everywhere. In the case of human consciousness, all people everywhere gravitate toward happiness, fulfillment, peace. We don't mean happiness in the superficial sense of just some smiley face, cheerful mood. We mean, you know, that deepest thing, the one we're always really looking for when we go after anything else. In any given moment, our attention is drawn automatically to whatever seems to offer the strongest dose of it. That's why, faster than you can think about it, your gaze is attracted to a good-looking person walking down the street, hence the term attractive. Those external sources of happiness and peace, the cookies, the cocktails, the careers, the copulation, are enticing, but also unreliable, because they're always coming, going, and changing. They're moving targets. What the sages teach, and what you just glimpsed in our first session, is that the core of our being, our own awareness, is a reliable, unchanging source of happiness and peace. So, instead of trying to push our way toward it or push other things out of the way, all we have to do is let ourselves be pulled. Automatically, we're drawn to it and we settle into it. Rather than a leaf falling to the ground, most people approach meditation like they're pushing a boulder up a mountain, fighting gravity rather than using it, grunting away at whatever task they've set themselves. They'll tell you meditation is hard, and in a way they're right. If you work hard at it, it's hard. Surprise. But if you take it easy, it's easy. Sooner or later, of course, gravity wins, even for those who struggle against it. But why not sooner? When a server in a restaurant asks me, "Are you still working on that?" my reply is, "No, I'm still enjoying it." Any tendency to work on this is just a habit you've imported from the tasks and challenges you confront during the other hours of the day, which legitimately require work. But every moment you spend just sitting and marinating in awareness, doing sweet nothing, dolce far niente, the old habit loses some of its grip on you. With dawning clarity, you find that you can just be, and that the graceful ease, the easy grace of just being, is available at all times. To cooperate fully with that dawning, there's just one crucial thing for you to do. Sit down for a little while every day, close your eyes, and let it happen. Then that ease starts to permeate your life, percolating through all its fibers, naturally dissolving and washing out the old gunky deposits of fear, rage, and self-destructive craving. More and more you feel okay, happy, and at peace, for no particular reason except that that's what you are at your core, and now your core is coming unburied. Your vision becomes clearer, so that you see solutions that might have gone overlooked. You do less walking around in circles, less bumping into things, less making easy things hard. As you awake and break free from the old distortions, a natural wisdom, bigger than the separate I with its little thoughts, emerges to guide your steps. Speaking in the voice of that wisdom, the prophet Isaiah described this awakening. I will lead the blind by a road they do not know. By paths they have not known, I will guide them. I will turn the darkness before them into light, the rough places into level ground. These are the things I will do, and I will not forsake them. Chapter 9. On-ramps. I think it was in the first grade that we started making projects with colored construction paper, glue, and little red-handled scissors with rounded tips. I remember sitting at the table with the other kids, toiling away, making a long, laborious cut, one tiny snip at a time. Once in a while, the teacher would drop by our table with her big, sharp, grown-up scissors and help move things along. Catching the edge of the paper far back, near the pivot point of her blades, and then, what? Leaving the blades wide open. She pushed her scissors forward in one smooth, straight glide. We looked at each other in bug-eyed disbelief. You've now learned the grown-up way to meditate. Stop toiling away, stay wide open, and it's an easy glide. This approach is so natural, so universal, that it's found in any number of venerable traditions, and has been independently discovered by seekers outside of the traditions. Sometimes folks who weren't even seeking have just stumbled into it. Because there's essentially nothing to it, what's most surprising is that anyone has missed it. In fact, it's so nothing that sometimes we might want a little bit of something to help us ease into it from, well, everything. When you've been dealing with the busy busyness of ordinary life, to just sit down and rest in awareness can seem pretty abrupt. This is why we have certain simple, neutral activities for transitioning smoothly to the ease of just being. Natural meditation, we could say, is like cruising on the freeway on a Sunday morning. The free way, the way of freedom. No intersections, no traffic lights, nothing to do but sit back, drop your foot on the gas, and burn up the miles. As you zoom along, there's no more G-force of acceleration. It feels magically like not moving at all. But when you're coming from the slow start-and-stop traffic of the surface streets, you need an on-ramp, or entrance ramp, or slip road, as it's called in some places, to ease onto the freeway. Then you can forget about the on-ramp and go merrily on your way. You've already learned a couple of practices, resting bliss face and breathing through your feet, that can double as excellent on-ramps. In addition, here are some that have been thoroughly tested over the centuries. Once you're seated comfortably, you can use any one you like. Sound. One of the simplest ways to transition into meditation is to just close your eyes and listen for a while, in a neutral, easygoing way, to the ambient sounds, the wind in the trees, the hum of the fridge, the traffic, the surf, the chatter of the kids in the playground, the clatter of your commuter train, whatever's there. Suppose your head is spinning after a rough day at work, or you've been riding the emotional roller coaster of an unsettled relationship. The neutrality of just listening to the ambient sounds becomes a sort of decompression space before settling within. Don't try to do anything about the sounds. Don't try to vigilantly monitor them, which would be a task. Just easily rest your attention there. After a little while, you can ask yourself, am I aware of these sounds? Sure. Then I'm aware? Of course. Then fine. Rest right here, in awareness. This approach also dispenses, once and for all, with the idea that sound is the enemy of meditation and needs to be blocked out. Sound is your friend. In fact, everything is your friend. The whole universe, you'll eventually find, is your friend. But the chirping of the sparrow or the whirring of the electric fan is a good place to start. I like to minimize meditation toys or paraphernalia, tchotchkes, as they're called in Sanskrit. But if you happen to have a bell or chime whose tone you like, preferably one with a nice long decay, fade, you might want to use that. Strike the bell and listen as it dwindles away. Let its pleasing sound catch your attention and then lead you into the silence. Three strikes is a traditional number. Three strikes and you're out. But you can do anything you like. You can also use sounds that you generate yourself, including mantras such as Om, the traditional sounds that are considered particularly conducive to meditative settling down. They generally have a smooth, soothing, mellifluous quality. Crepuscular, coruscation, pulchritudinous, or ichthyosaurus would make really bad mantras. If there's a mantra you're fond of, you can sing or say it aloud, or sub-vocalize it as a murmur or a whisper, or just have it lightly in your mind. Or you can do a diminuendo. First vocalize the mantra, then sub-vocalize it, then lightly think it, then vaguely, almost subliminally feel it, then let it fade in its own time into silence, and just rest there. I especially like the natural mantra, the one that, no matter what language you speak, you already associate with letting go into okayness. When you finally get that piece of popcorn husk out from between your back teeth, when you finish doing your taxes, when you get to the last chapter of the murder mystery and discover that the butler did it, when you have an orgasm, when you find the perfect shoes for your outfit and they're 50% off, there's a good chance that you spontaneously say, ah. And because the connection between outer and inner works both ways, by using this sound, you can evoke letting go. Say it or sing it, think it or sigh it, feel it radiate out in all directions through all your pores. Simple breathing. With your mouth closed, take a full breath, a little deeper and slower than usual. Pay attention to the experience of each moment as you breathe all the way in. At the end of the inhalation, pause. Don't think of it as holding the breath, which sounds like straining. Just fill up with breath and notice that you can rest on the full breath in a perfectly easygoing way, like sitting on a nice fat cushion. Then keep paying attention as you slowly breathe all the way out, and then pause again at the end of the exhalation, sitting on the cushion of emptiness. Don't force or strain. Rather, note what a delicious privilege it is to breathe. Only people who are alive get to do it. This offer good for a limited time only. Like eating, breathing is necessary for survival, but you can go through your life mindlessly wolfing down your meals, or you can be a gourmet, deeply relishing and gratefully appreciating the gift of fine food. This is gourmet breathing. Take one breath like this, or a few, or go on enjoying deep, conscious breathing for a while. If you get lightheaded, stop. You're probably straining. After a while, forget about the breath and just rest in awareness. Again, the inner-outer connection works both ways. People suffering from anxiety or having panic attacks usually take short, shallow breaths through the mouth. By breathing slowly, luxuriously, and through the nose, we cultivate the opposite of panic. Advanced breathing. To add some extra oomph to this procedure, slightly constrict the back of your throat so that it makes a mild, rasping sound as you breathe in and out, like Darth Vader, a happy, relaxed Darth Vader. Narrowing the air passage slows down your breathing, and because you can hear and feel the breath more vividly, the experience is richer and gives you more to rest your attention on. This constriction also stimulates the vagus nerve, or 10th cranial nerve. One of the most extraordinary structures in the human body, it's actually a pair of nerves that reach from the lower brain all the way down to the diaphragm. Stimulating it helps to switch off the sympathetic branch of the nervous system and switch on the parasympathetic branch. This deactivates the fight-or-flight syndrome, where the body is coiled for action in a state of hyperarousal with the typical symptoms of pounding heart, dry mouth, and sweaty palms. In its place, the vagus nerve activates an opposite response with slower heart rate and overall mind-body relaxation, variously known as the rest and digest, feed and breed, or graze and gaze syndrome. Studies of veterans with PTSD have shown that this technique can significantly lower their stress markers. Yogis, who call this method Ujjayi, victorious breath, have known about its power for centuries. You can make this Ujjayi, Darth Vader breathing, more powerful still by adjusting the relative length of your breaths. Let the breath again be fairly slow, and this time count how many seconds one in-breath takes. Then, after the pause, breathe out extra slowly so that the out-breath takes about 1.5 to 2 times as long as the in-breath. If, say, you breathe in for a count of 6, breathe out for a count of 9 to 12. Then continue like that. Don't strain or feel rigid about getting the count just right on every breath. That would defeat the purpose. No one's giving you a grade. This style of breathing is particularly beneficial for people who are in, or want to be in, recovery from substance addiction, as well as those suffering from anxiety, fear, confusion, worry, agitation, or any kind of emotional ups and downs, whether chronic or acute. In fact, studies of resting breath rates have shown that subjects with lower levels of those difficult emotions naturally tend to breathe at this ratio, with the out-breath 1.5 to 2 times the length of the in-breath. Sometimes the easiest way to start being a calm, stable, balanced person is to breathe like one. As you settle into this breathing, let your eyes close. Then you can add another dimension to the experience by imagine feeling as we did when we breathed through our feet back in Chapter 2. This time, though, imagine feel your whole body to be porous, like a sponge with extremely fine pores, thousands of them per square inch. As you breathe in and out, slowly and attentively, using the Ujjayi constriction if you like, feel the breath pouring in and out through all those fine, fine pores, coming in from all directions and going out in all directions into infinite space. Here's another version of that inner seeing, feeling, breathing. Start the in-breath with your attention way down at the very base of your spine. Then, as you breathe in, slowly ride the breath up the spine, all the way to the top of the skull, and then keep going so that when you rest in the fully inhaled state, you're resting the attention in the space just above your head. Then, as you breathe out, ride back down again. So when you rest in the exhaled state, you're again at the base of the spine. The super deluxe variation is to combine this up and down the spine method with ujjayi breath and the longer out than in ratio. That may take a little getting used to at first, but then you'll find it incredibly powerful. Among other things, you'll find it almost impossible to remember what you were upset about or what substance you were craving. Object gazing. Let your gaze rest on something, anything in front of you. A rock, a flower, the sea or a lake, a spot on the wall or floor, the palms of your hands. If you like looking at a picture of a favorite sacred or enlightened person, that's fine. Don't stare at the object. Don't try to concentrate on it. Don't try not to blink. Don't try to analyze it intellectually or relate to it emotionally. Simply rest your gaze there. Resting your gaze on an object is like setting an apple on the kitchen counter. Once you've placed it there, you don't have to keep on placing it. The apple mostly stays there by itself, but if at some point you notice that it's rolled onto the floor, fine, just place it there again. Remember, the object is there to serve you as a means of easing into meditation. You're not getting paid to serve it by straining for some kind of perfect, unbroken focus. After a little while, close your eyes, forget about the object, and just rest in silent awareness. Sky gazing. Traditionally popular in Tibet, where the thin, dry atmosphere produces brilliant, crystal-clear skies, this approach is like object gazing, but, well, bigger, more expansive. You can do it while reclining on a deck chair or lying on your back on the grass or in a hammock, or seated any place where you have a fairly unobstructed view of the sky. As with object gazing, don't try to stare or to resist blinking. Just easily allow your attention, led by your gaze, to rest, mingle, merge, and lose itself in the openness of the sky. The Tibetans associate the visual openness of the sky with the sonic openness of the mantra, Ah. And they associate both of them with the ultimate openness of silent awareness. To put it all together, rest your gaze in the sky, take a deep in-breath, then say or sing a long, strong, Ah. Imagining the sound emanating from all your pores, your fingers, your toes, your scalp, your eyeballs, everything radiating into the open, endless sky. Do this three times, then rest in awareness. Swaying, orbiting, swinging. Swaying works best if you're sitting cross-legged with your back unsupported rather than on a chair or couch. It's used in traditional Zen meditation, which is done on a zafu cushion, sitting with straight but not rigid posture. Once you're seated, rock your body side to side like a metronome. Move from the hips so that the whole spine up to the head remains aligned. Start by swaying in a wide arc and gradually let the arc shorten till your movement is so subtle that an observer would have trouble telling whether you're still moving or not. Then let the movement grow more subtle still till you're finally not moving at all. If you have trouble telling exactly when you've stopped, that's good. A variation of this swaying is orbiting. Again, sitting with your back unsupported, keep your bottom planted in one spot on your cushion and orbit around that spot, as if you're drawing an ice cream cone with your torso. Start with big circles and gradually let them spiral in, becoming smaller and smaller till they're imperceptible and finally they vanish. Both of these methods are very effective for getting centered, literally, physically, and for participating bodily in an act of slowing down into stillness. They're also great for children who want to do something meditative. Most kids before the age of about 11 or 12 are too squirmy to sit in silent meditation for more than a minute or two, if at all. But they happily take to physical approaches like these. They also generally work well for people of any age with such conditions as ADD, ADHD, or hypertension. One more variation is available if you have a hammock. Just flop down into it, shove off with your foot to start it swinging, close your eyes, and thoroughly give yourself up to its motion as it gradually becomes more subtle. The hammock, by the way, is an excellent example of the principle of meditative practice eloquently laid out by the wise troubadour Sly Stone. Different strokes for different folks. Some people hate the motion of a hammock and even find that it makes them seasick. Some find that meditating lying down just makes them dull and sleepy. And some find that the hammock's motion is as soothing and comforting as a mother rocking her baby. And that abiding in restful alertness is just as feasible when lying on their backs as when sitting on their bottoms. Heart Center. Certain meditative systems identify specific locations within the body that are conducive to resting the attention. The heart area is a particularly comfortable and soothing place for many people. We're not talking about the physical organ that pumps blood, but rather the energy center that happens to be in its vicinity. In traditional lore, of course, that's the seat of love. But let's be good scientists and see what our experience tells us. My experience is that when I'm heartbroken or heartsick, or I have a heavy heart, or my heart is bursting with love or empathy or awe, I notice strong sensations in the middle of my chest that certainly feel like the emotional energies those words describe. They're heartfelt. Working with the Heart Center, unsurprisingly, is indicated for anyone who wants to be more in touch with these feelings. I've found it especially helpful for coming out of anger. As usual, the method is simple. Sitting with closed eyes, just bring your attention to a place deep inside the chest cavity, like going deep inside a cave. As with the other on-ramps, don't try to force the mind to concentrate or focus. Don't try to give the heart center any particular size or quality. Just rest there. After a little while, you'll probably feel a sense of ease centered in the heart, and perhaps a subtle warmth. The heart center may seem to become very small or vast, or you may feel you're dissolving into it, or you may not, all of which is fine. At some point, forget about the heart center and just rest in awareness. Do it yourself. No matter what on-ramp you take, the basic principles are the same. Use any one that's comfy, use it with a light touch, use it for a little while, and then forget about it, let it go. There's no need to ritualize or fetishize the on-ramp. Do that for a couple of centuries, and it's called a religion. Just as with a freeway on-ramp, we get on to get off. The point is to ease into the express lane of just being as soon as possible. When someone tells me, "Yep, I've been meditating on my mantra for 30 years," I wonder, "Geez, when are you going to let it go and enjoy some silence?" You can also help yourself to a quick dose of any of these methods during the day, especially at moments when fear or anxiety, anger or craving well up. When you're jonesing for the drink or drug that you know you shouldn't have, instead of just suffering, you can, say, melt into some ahs instead. When you open up the final exam and feel the room spinning and your mouth going dry, you can interrupt the stress cycle by, say, taking a minute to follow a few deep ujjayi breaths in and out. You'll probably think you can't afford to spend that precious minute of exam time just breathing, but actually, you can't afford not to. There are no rigid rules about this stuff. You'll quickly become the expert on what's called for at any given moment. You may feel most at home on one on-ramp for a few days or months, then find yourself drawn to another. You can't go wrong. The more you keep the whole project a matter